Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Defending. It's a topic we discuss so often in football, but do we really understand the mechanics of it?
You can look at every single goal we've conceded a day and you're scratching your head as if to say, goodness me, how poor was our defending.
Every goal that is scored is analysed for mistakes by markers.
Phil Jones got done on the header from Harry Kane on the first. The second, Smalling stepped up and left Herrera, who's then made the mistake for the second. And the third, Chris Smalling's got skipped past for Mara.
Recovery tackles are celebrated more than intelligent positioning.
The amount of times he actually gets them out of trouble with his pace.
We get caught up in cliches and fail to appreciate the decision-making process, rarely looking beyond just the final error during a passage of play. I've long wanted to gain a greater perspective of what it's like to be part of a backline, especially at the heart of it. Joining me on Between the Lines is a man very well versed in exactly this.
Julian Lescott with the touch, Manchester City lead.
He was player of the season twice at Wolves and got the player's player honour twice at Everton.
And would you believe it, he's Everton's leading scorer this season. It's his fourth goal already, the defender.
Oh, and then he only went and lifted the league twice with Manchester City. Julian Lescott is our guide to the art of defending. Julian, thanks so much for being our oracle on defending. But you didn't actually see yourself playing at the back. Ian Wright was your hero growing up, and you fancied yourself as a striker. Are there any defenders who actually wanted to become one when they were a kid?
Probably back when I was younger, no. Everyone wanted to play forward, and then as you got older, you realised there was better people at playing that, and then your understanding of the game was better suited to defending. So I'm not sure. I know anyone that was a defender from like under 10s, 11s, and then stayed there. It was normally everyone was strikers under league academies, and then you started off in the position you recruited in and then you just filtered back. Probably only goalkeepers is probably the only position that you actually stayed in.
It's actually quite fascinating you mentioned that, because positions sometimes can happen by chance. That's so common. You dropped into midfield and then at Wolves, the centre half was ill one week. They'd asked you to fill in. What was that initial adjustment like, moving into defence? And did you think at the time it was only going to be temporary?
Well, that was it. When I first went to Wolves, I was brought in as a midfielder. Another, like, icon idol was Paul Linton. He was, like, the person I modelled my game on. Because, again, back then it was 4-4-2, so you just box-to-box midfielders. And I got signed and recruited as a midfielder. And then, like you said, one of the defenders that had been there for a bit longer than me was ill for a couple of weeks, and I was going to play there, but I was happy to play there. It's my first kind of experience of an academy, so just to be part of it was fine. And then after the 2 weeks has come and he's back fit and I'm still back there, and as they're saying, oh, we kind of see your long-term future there. And as well as I was potentially doing at the time, I just wasn't enjoying it. So I was like, nah, this isn't for me. So I chose to leave. I was like, I just want to play midfield. But above all, I want to enjoy it. And if I'm not enjoying it, it doesn't matter where I'm going to play. There's no point in me going. So took that decision and then just got back into playing grassroots, school team, as many games as I could play in, but none of them was at the back.
Is that actually quite a difficult thing as a kid? Like when you're still quite young and still growing into the game, you know, you've got an idea of what your position is, what you like doing, and then you get told, hang on, actually, that's not the vision we have for you. Is that quite an odd thing to digest at a young age still?
Yeah, it was for me. Again, it's, I think there's a bit more rotation now throughout the academy, so you probably do play multiple positions and just experience it for various reasons. But at the time, you kind of was recruited as a position or a player, and then you played in that position and developed that position. And as I said, like the enjoyment of playing centre half wasn't there for me. I just didn't enjoy doing it. I wanted to run around, basically. I enjoyed being able to run the length of the field, run back, tackle, score goals, all the other things that come with being in midfield. That was my sole decision, was just to enjoy it. And then my last year of school, obviously, I realised I wanted to become a footballer. And my school teacher had been telling me, like, you're not going to be a midfielder. Like, if you're going to be a footballer, it's going to be at the back. And then I kind of realised that was where it was at. So I kind of stuck to that position then and realised this is where I'm going to have a future. And again, it wasn't like I wasn't enjoying it then. I'd realised then. I also realised I was good at it. And obviously, as a kid, when you're good at something, you enjoy doing it, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. What actually shocked you about the position at first? Because obviously, you know, you get told do the basics right, get right side of your man, all those kind of simple terminologies that get used for it. But when you're actually adjusting to it and having to function as a defender, what was like, whoa, this is actually quite deep. This is a lot to get my head around.
I don't know. Good question, but I don't know if I ever thought there was a thing like that. I just, as I said, the more detail I was given or things I was asked to do, the more enjoyment I got out of it. So as it got kind of more in depth and there was more like elements to it and the art of it kind of was developing. Again, I probably started at an era where you just had to defend, head it, clear it and stuff like that. But then it was starting to become a thing where you was getting on the ball and you was passing in between the lines. So I kind of experienced that at a young age. And again, that was, now the enjoyment was there because that was the midfield element I enjoyed, being on the ball and being able to pass. So it enhanced my enjoyment, but also being like, enjoyed the defending side of it, like being able to read the situation when forwards are getting it and what they want to do and stop that and prevent it from happening. And again, with playing there, you're facing different types of strikers. So again, it was the kind of, before analysis was around, you'd turn up on a Saturday, whether youth team or whatever, reserves, and you didn't know who you was playing against. So you just got out there and there was no kind of footage of him playing the week before. So it was just like, oh, figure it out in 10 minutes because it's the game. So the first 10 minutes, you figured out who you were playing against, what his strengths were, what his weaknesses were, and you just had to kind of deal with it.
How much do the demands of the position change based on the forward you'll be up against? Marking a Sergio Aguero is a whole different sport to marking a Peter Crouch.
Yeah, again, and it varies for whatever reason that be. But at the highest level, there's always a very high level of intelligence and technical ability. So them things are consistent throughout. But as you said, you just kind of have to now recognise, with the help of of analysts have to recognise what they do and don't like to do, and try and create scenarios that they're not comfortable. Like growing up and playing, I always kind of felt that out of the four possible main attributes that people would look at, whether it be technique, tactical, physical, and intelligence, it was like, as long as I felt I was on top with two, three of them, I would be okay. And that was the case pretty much throughout my youth career. And then the first experience I got when I knew there was another level was against Louis Saha at Fulham, when he really gave me, he really let me know there was another level. And that was mainly due to tactical and understanding and intelligence, because physically I could match people. But even that day I wasn't able to match him physically, but also his intelligence around it. And it made me really know there's a lot more depth to it.
So how did you change then after that experience against Louis Saha?
To be honest, I came a better professional after that. Everything. And it just, as I said, I just didn't want to be in a position where I wasn't in control. Like, again, there's going to be people that are faster than me, are better technically than me, tactically than me. But I just hadn't experienced someone that was all of them on one given time. So it made me just enhance all of them things. And it just, I just took a logical approach to, I'm enhancing mine, so everyone else is going to have to enhance theirs. And if they are doing that, then it's a great contest.
Have you ever thanked him?
No. I've always said he's the best player I've ever played against. And it was probably the first time I spoke to him was when he joined Everton. And I just said to him then, like, that time, he honestly made me feel like I wasn't going to be able to compete at the level. And this was the Championship. This wasn't even in the Premier League. So, as I said, it was just a crazy thing to experience. And again, it wasn't like that was the first bad game I'd ever had. I'd had bad games before, but it was due to making mistakes, where in that game I didn't make any mistakes. I just wasn't in control of anything. So again, that's why I was able to realize.
You spoke about making mistakes there. Do you think one of the key things, especially as a defender, where an error can be so critical, is that you have to learn how to psychologically deal with it, put it behind you, just carry on and not let it affect your mindset in the game?
Oh, 100%. Everyone will make a mistake. The best players make them less often, and they're able to deal with it better. And that is the difference. It sounds pretty simple, but you just look and think, like, there's going to be an incident where a defender is at fault for a goal. And how often is he making that decision depends on how well he's viewed. Like, if we look at, say, John Stones, to the mistakes he was making in the last couple of seasons, he's just not making them anymore. And it's not that he's doing anything exceptional. He's just not making them mistakes. And that's the difference. And all of a sudden, he's back to where we all believed he was and could be.
How difficult is it to get that psychological conditioning right when you have made a critical error? What are the steps to not let it get to you?
A good support network is key. Because again, it is difficult. You don't want to make them errors. You don't intentionally decide to let someone go past you and concede and stuff like that. So it is difficult, but you just have to do the right things. As long as you're making a mistake in the right way, because that is a thing. Decisions and mistakes can be unfortunate, but there are mistakes that you choose to do and that you shouldn't be doing. Like, for instance, I as a young player, wanting to play there was a time and a place when to do that. So there's a couple of times I remember one of my old coaches, a mentor of mine, Terry Connor, used to criticize me for wanting to bring it down. And it wasn't because I was doing it, it's because it was the wrong area. And he was saying, that's the mistake. The mistake isn't you trying to control it. The mistake is where you're trying to control it. And then he would help me understand where that was a strength and where it would be the weakness. And again, it's just helping, he just helped me understand that, not that he wanted to take it away, and he just helped me develop the decision-making process, which for me is arguably the most important aspect of any player, whether they be physically dominant. Their decision-making is key to what, how successful they are. If they make the right decisions, more often than not, they will be successful. And that isn't the decision of, well, I've seen a Kevin De Bruyne play that pass, let me play it. No, it's the best decision for your capabilities.
That's an interesting point, because on the last episode of Between the Lines, we had the Gladbach assistant coach, René Marek, on the show. And he said a manager's job is not to win games. Players do that. And managers have to give you the framework to try and make the best decisions on the pitch. Which manager have you felt has given you that?
Glenn Huddle. Glenn Huddle, he came to Wolves, and he, even when I hear him now talk to about football, he's the best pundit. Whenever he talks about it, it's so detailed but so simple, which is an art. And he's obviously had that from when he played, because he came to Wolves and he made me view the game in a way that hadn't been explained, and also offered me detail to my position, again, that hadn't been given, made me understand there was a level of professionalism that needed to be had and maintained, and not just on a Friday, day before a game, and then on a Saturday. It was consistent. I absorbed the most information from him. And again, I don't know if it was just because I was able to understand the way he was speaking, but even when he was addressing other positions, it made sense. Positions I'd never played, but it made sense what he was saying. And it was just logical. And I just thought, he's not using crazy terms or words or phrases. It was just, no, look at it from this point of view. If you do this, this only leaves him with that option, which means then you are in control of this situation. And I was just like, wow, that's how simple the game can be. And then it's down to the individual to make the right decisions.
That's brilliant. Actually, Huddle's name comes up quite a bit when you speak to players. Are you then surprised that he hasn't had more opportunities in management?
Yeah. I would have loved to have worked with him later on in my career, when I was probably at the peak, physical peak and intelligence-wise. It would have been great to understand that again. I was 21 when he was at Wolves, and that was the first time we'd ever analysed opposition. We analysed our own games and the opposition, and again, that was new then. People weren't doing that. Pre-activation, like before training, was kind of new. Well, was very new. So there was a lot of things that he was bringing in that I just hadn't experienced. And by the time they were normal standards, I would have loved to have the opportunity to see if there was anything else he would have been able to enhance me, my thought processing.
Now, it's quite something to be player of the season as a defender, but yeah, you kind of made a habit of that. So in your words, how would you describe the art of being a good defender?
Describe the art. Just making it as difficult as you can for the opposition, and being a team player. There's great individual defenders. I've played with some, I've seen some, but for me it was, yes, I may have received accolades at certain times in my career, but can I can I help my teammates? Can I not let them be exposed? If I can prevent something from happening, do so. And if I can prevent it happening to them or for them, then again, do so. Where I've seen, and I still see it now, defenders not make choices based on, it's not their fault. Like, if this goes wrong, it won't be my fault. And I'm thinking, that's not the way to defend. The defender is okay. If I can help him, we go down together, rather than, that's not my man. And that was always a conscious decision. Like, I've got no problem making honest mistakes. If it was the right thing to do and it was the wrong execution, that's okay. It was when it's the wrong thing you should be doing. You shouldn't be doing that. And even if the execution is okay, I'd be like, I know I shouldn't be doing that.
How much did the requirements of the position change from Wolves to Everton to Manchester City?
They probably changed the most Everton. Again, the level was high. It was the Premier League, so obviously the whole detail of it, the attributes of the players was different to what I'd experienced. Again, playing in the Championship, I was able to. I always believed physically I was going to be better than my opponent, even before we got on the pitch. And then 9 times out of 10, I was more kind of tactically aware, and being that would have allowed me to take chances I shouldn't take, because I knew when physically I'd get out of trouble. But I was instantly aware that wasn't going to be the case in the Premier League. Physically, I wasn't going to be guaranteed to be better than anyone else. Tactically, definitely not. So I kind of realised that early on. And then obviously playing fullback. And as much as early on I didn't enjoy playing as a defender, I loved 1v1. That was the best part of being a defender, was you versus someone else. And that was why I enjoyed playing as a fullback, not so much getting forward. And I scored some goals there. They were the things that I just did because it was part of the structure of the team. But I loved being faced up 1v1 and be saying, okay, now it's me versus you. There's no one else to help or support. It's just you versus me, and then who comes out on top.
And then at Manchester City, where the expectation is then to win things and to win it immediately, did that alter the way you saw your game?
No, not really. I even think it now, when we expect people to go to a new club or a higher level and do something different. I was just in the mindset of, well, you've bought me because I can do these things. If I do these things at this club, it will be viewed as a more positive. But I don't have to do anything else. I don't have to do more. I just have to be able to do what I've been doing. Yes, it may be more frequent. And the level will go up if we reach the Champions League, which it did. But it's doing the same things, just at different levels. Again, I don't know if that makes sense to everyone, but to me, that was my thought process of obviously just do what I've been doing. And if the level is higher, then great. Like if you analyze it and say, if say it gets go back to John Stones, if he does what he's been doing in the Euros, he will arguably be one of the best defenders in the Euros. But we're not asking him to do any more. Just do what you've been doing and just keep it at that level and make sure that the decisions you're making are consistent. And that was kind of my process, was, well, I've done something at Everton. I've made these decisions at Everton. It's worked. Again, the Premier League was similar. In the greatest respect, I was going to be with better players. So I probably have to make them less often because we have the ball more. And it's only really the Champions League when I'm like, now we're at a level where the players are better. And again, you're not guaranteed to be more intelligent, physically better. So just be more aware.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Stakhanov's award-winning football mockumentary, The Offensive, is available to listen to now. After securing Premier League survival last season, Ashwood City have a new boss.
The new manager, Sven Goran Eriksson.
I am delighted to be the new head coach at Ashwood City Football Club.
But unfortunately, the same old chief executive.
Fuckity fuck. Stupid comments from an ex-player chanting make Ashwood great again. Big fucking deal. You know, if he thinks that any of those empty words have had even the slightest impact on Patrick Nolan, MBE, then he is dreaming. Stupid, big idiot, twat, fucking wank, bollocks face.
Follow Ashwood City on and off the pitch every Premier League match week.
I can't even get easy peelers in my local M&S at the moment, Sven, let alone a fullback from Real Sociedad.
I just have a list of players I'd like to bring into your squad.
Okay, well, let me know when you have a list of players you'd like to bring out of the squad.
Described by The Guardian as a must-listen for football fans.
We lied about the corona test result. We isolated our two informed players to stop them playing for England. And now we've asked Man City Football Club to bribe the Premier League on our behalf.
I didn't actually ask them to. I asked if they wanted to.
It's the same fucking thing.
Search The Offensive on your favourite podcast player and listen now.
Oh, now then, Cisse's in behind. Can change it. One chance.
Speaking of City, and we touched on mistakes earlier, were you relieved that your missed time header, which let Cisse equalise for QPR, wasn't the defining moment in that game? That we did have the Aguero?
Oh yeah, obviously. I was like, that is one of the highlights of my career, that moment. The kind of mistake, it wasn't great, obviously, but I was able to deal with that at the time because, like I said before, it wasn't something I shouldn't have done. I wasn't trying to bring it down and got caught out. It was a mistimed header that I should have gone for, and that was the difference. So as I said, like my mentor earlier on made me aware of that. Mistakes are going to happen. It's just, what type of mistake are you making? And again, off the back of that, I went onto the Euros and scored a goal for my country. And we got to the quarterfinals of the Euros. So I didn't even think about it at all, to be honest. Not that I was dismissive to it. I was just like, it was a mistake. I'd made mistakes in previous games. I'd made worse mistakes. I probably made worse decisions in the Euros, but again, they didn't lead to goals. And that's what I try and say to players now that I work with. Don't wait for it to lead to a goal in order for you to learn from that. Like, if you can learn from your mistakes before they've gone to a goal, or you can watch someone else and say, I wouldn't make that decision, then you're learning faster than everybody else, because everyone says learn from your mistakes, and that could be the last one you make and you could be out of the team and that could be the consequence.
Do you get annoyed with the way the game is analysed sometimes, because the focus is often on the final mistake rather than the errors in the build-up, you know, maybe in midfield or from the strikers? There's also no differentiation between a mistake where you've just messed up and made a bad decision, or where you've made the right decision but the execution's not come off.
Yeah, very much so. Like as you said then, mistake and a decision, they're different things. Like, let's talk about Arsenal Wolves and David Luiz. Like, David Luiz gave away a penalty. That's the mistake. The decision, but for me, when I'm looking at that goal, I'm looking at decision Holding's made and the way he's narrowed off and allowed, not allowed, but let the passing angle be bigger for the ball to be played into. That's a bigger mistake for me. So I'm saying David Luiz, he hasn't meant to do that. Like, you can see he's trying to avoid it, but Holding's made the decision to go inside and let that ball go there. And again, no one's going to look at that and think he made that mistake, because he wasn't the last mistake made. So again, like you're saying, yeah, that is a frustration, that there are a lot of instances where the final execution is deemed the worst. And I'm saying there's a lot more that happens before that. And most of the time, it's the penultimate decision that is the bigger error.
You've been involved in post-match analysis as a player with the manager and the backroom team. You've sat and watched it on TV, and now you're actually involved in the panel that analyzes matches. How different has the experiences been from a player to the analysis you are now involved in on TV?
Yeah, it's a lot less emotional, obviously, on TV. I try to give a diplomatic view of why it occurred, but also you can't stop a goal, for instance, because it wouldn't be a goal if you could stop it. But there's not everything is preventable anyway. So I think the kind of analytical side from a punditry point of view has solely become, well, who was at fault? Whose fault was that? And it's not always the case. Some players are better than others at their role in the team, so we just have to appreciate that. But as a manager, as a coach, and as someone that works with players, I tended to hold myself accountable for everything and work backwards. So I could have prevented that. What could have done, and then be really kind of strict on, you couldn't have done that. So let's not overanalyze it. And that's the way I kind of work, or ask the players I work with to view it and say, well, we'll look at, especially defenders, say, well, let's look at every goal and say you could prevent it. You're at fault for every goal. And then we'll look back and say, well, what really was you at fault for? Rather than, that wasn't my man. Maybe I could have done that. I think accountability as a professional is huge for growth and progression. But as a pundit, I think we need to analyse that there's brilliance and people are better at their roles.
That's a good point, because so often you'll just see a great goal and you'll marvel at it, and yet there is still always this insistence on, ah, well, he's let him get away from him there, and that's the result of bad defending. Sometimes great players just score great goals.
Yeah, that is exactly what it is. And as I said, that's what it's become. I think the setup of teams has allowed that to happen more often because most teams, I think if you look at an average team in the Premier League now from 10 years ago, they probably are more expansive in terms of in possession. So again, you can't have it both ways. I remember watching a team and a player and a coach and hearing great things about them. But when I looked at their setup, I was like, yeah, but he's never in a position to prevent anything from happening. So the plaudits he was getting, I was like, yeah, but if you look at it really, he could do a lot more to prevent his team from conceding. But because the setup was different and he was just in a position to get on the ball all the time, which I think happens a lot. I think defenders are asked to start attacks and be part of that, which is great. But you're also then left in a position when it breaks down that you can't recover. You just won't be able to recover. And again, it's looked at, well, he shouldn't be there. No, he was asked to be there at the start, but you can't always then get back.
Yeah, I was actually going to touch on that. The evolution of the position in terms of centre-backs and full-backs, where the latter has to almost be part of the attack. They're your creative weapons, and your centre-backs have to have the passing range of a midfielder now, which is demanding a lot more of the position. And like you say, that's bound to lead to a lot more risk and therefore more errors.
Yeah. Again, the game's evolved and it's an entertainment and it's enjoyable to watch. Yeah, we do have to realise that not every defender is able to do that. And if they was, one, they probably wouldn't be at the level they're at and in the position they're in. If they could play that pass 9 times out of 10, they wouldn't be at the back. They would be in midfield. They would be up front in advanced position. So that needs to be recognised. And when I hear about keepers not being able to play, and I'm like, I understand what you're saying, but of course. So I don't get why then 90%, 80% of teams try to do it, when if he could do that in the greatest respect, he wouldn't be there. He would be at the top 2%. Which again, I don't feel is recognised enough to say, yeah, he may have made a mistake, or he can do it in training. It's not the same. It just isn't the same. So you have to take that in consideration.
In saying all of this, who's the most enjoyable partner you've had?
There's two. Like Vinny, obviously, we had a lot of success and it was great because we won stuff. But Jagielka was equally as good for me. We were just on the same page. We were just, it was just like we'd known each other well. We knew each other anyway from like under 18s, England and stuff like that.
When we look at those elite players, we obviously zone in on their skill set. But do you think the leadership of those kind of players often gets ignored? Just taking Vincent Kompany, for example, with Manchester City, perhaps they didn't foresee the extent of how much the team would miss not having him around, not just on the pitch, but in the dressing room, and just for his sort of guidance qualities, his persona and aura.
Oh, I don't think they missed it. I think it was understood. I think it may have been underestimated a little, not through the club's point of view, but what that aura does to opposition. Like, I've played with Vinny, and when you're facing a striker and it was Vinny and he was at the height of his powers, they would play on me thinking, well, I'm not going to get any change out of Vinny. I'll go and play on. Let's go. So that was kind of where it was at, and I'd been that guy. So I'd been that player that was, well, you're not really going to get anything out of him, so let's go and play on the other one. So I think that is underestimated. I also believe, or I know, Vinny made tackles that other people wouldn't get away with. And his relationship and his persona and his aura allowed it to be a foul and rather than a yellow. And then all of a sudden you're playing on a yellow card for 80 minutes. So them are the things that go underestimated. Like, for instance, if you look at Jesus and Sergio Aguero, they're top players. But not seeing Aguero has a different feel. Like when we played United throughout my career and there wasn't a Wayne Rooney, you were grateful. Regardless of who else was up there, the other talent they had, it wasn't Wayne Rooney. And that's probably the thing that was probably underestimated from a Vinny point of view at the start of the season, from a David Silva point of view and Yaya Toure and possibly a Sergio.
We've seen City, though, go on a remarkable run. They're posting elite numbers and they've erase their vulnerability, which used to be, you know, losing the ball in transition and then getting hit on the counter. They were so prone to being hurt that way. But you've seen Ruben Dias come in now, and we were talking about, you know, defenders having to be more expansive and stuff, but he's a more traditional, aggressive, front foot type, go and attack everything player. How much of a difference has he made?
He's made a massive difference. I don't know if he is that, though. Again, when I look at him, and he's been remarkable, but he hasn't been remarkable because he's doing anything that I haven't seen done before. He's just doing it more often. That's the difference. He's like, as a defender, if I was a defender playing now, I wouldn't look at Dias and think he's doing something I can't do. He's just doing it a lot more often. He's just doing the right thing every time. Like, is he doing more than, say, John Stones? Is he doing anything different to John Stones? I'm not so sure. Is he doing anything different to anyone else when they have a good game? No, but his good games are every week. And that is the key to being a good defender. It isn't what you can do that others can't. It's just how often you do the right things. And the biggest compliment I can play him is that he's so reliable in every aspect, whether it be heading, passing, clearing, but also selection. He's available for every game, which is huge.
I'm happy you brought up availability there, because that's probably one of the most important things when you are playing at centre-back and in defence, because, you know, having that consistency there is so vital. And then to look at Liverpool and their injury situation with all their senior fit centre-backs out injured, how destabilizing is that to the system, to their solidity, and then the psychological effect? Because it's not just losing Virgil van Dijk, you're losing Matip, you're losing Gomez, and you're losing the foundation of what you had as a team that made you successful.
That wasn't given as an excuse last year when Man City had lost theirs, and Fernandinho had then had to go into midfield. He was arguably the best holding midfielder, same for Liverpool and Fabinho. You don't just lose one player. As you said, the whole structure of your team is affected. Like, the fact that Jordan Henderson is playing well as a centre-back is hindering their team, because what he gives in midfield is far more valuable. But unless you have someone... And that's why I credit Liverpool for not realising they needed reliable centre-backs. Not the best centre-backs. They didn't go and buy the best up-and-coming centre-back that was available. They just went and bought people they know are going to be fit, which would allow other players to be in their best positions. And that is so important to what it's about. And like we said, even I think it will matter in the biggest games, because you need your best players. And they, for whatever reason, they perform in the best games. So if the last stage of the Champions League or possibly even the weekend when City play Liverpool, yeah, you may miss a Virgil van Dijk. But 9 times out of 10, you'll probably miss a Jordan Henderson in midfield more because he's playing at the back, or Fabinho. And again, that was the Fernandinho situation last season. In the big games, it's that aura. It's, are you playing against Virgil van Dijk? You're playing against Vincent Kompany? You're playing against Sergio Aguero? But if it's not them individuals, I don't care who you are, you're grateful. As much as you want to face and be judged against the best, in the biggest games, you're grateful if they're not involved.
Who, for you, is the best centre-back in the world?
You'd have to say Van Dijk. You'd have to say that Varane is up there. PK, as much as he gets criticised for his lack of mobility, he doesn't tend to make bad decisions. See, like Ramos would make more wrong decisions for me, but he's regarded as a far better player because he does other things that are noticeable, which again is what the game has become. It's who's becoming more noticeable. And that was never the way I wanted to defend. I didn't have the ability to do that anyway, probably early in my career, but not as I got older, I realized that wasn't my strength, my ability lighted up in other areas, which allowed other people to do what they were good at.
That's a good point, because often you see like a defender getting praised for making loads of recovery tackles, where if they were in the right position in the first place, they wouldn't have had to.
Oh, don't get me started.
Yeah.
Prevention is better than cure, as they say. Like, for me, Rio Ferdinand is the best defender has ever been in the Premier League. I don't think there's 5 instances where I've seen him slide. Like, there was never. And then you have, say, a John Terry, who arguably the best as well, and other defenders that make last-ditch tackles. I'm like, yeah, but Rio would have seen that on the halfway line. So that pass would never even got there. That was a difference.
Yeah, it's the highlights that catch the eye, but that's a lack of understanding of what the position actually entails.
Yeah, as I said, prevention is better than cure. Like, there's no other way to explain it better than that.
When you were learning the position and getting comfortable in it, who were the centre-backs that you looked at to try and extract things from?
Keith Kill was a good one for me at Wolves, being such a young player coming through. Any he offered me good detail, to be fair to him, in techniques more so than general play. Rio was the one that, again, like I've said, he was the best for me. Des Walker, again, an underrated defender for me. Loved 1v1. Players I played with as well. I played with some good players that helped me understand how to be good with what I had. Not necessarily they had the same attributes, but they helped me understand. Like Paul Butler at Wolves was good. He made me aware of things that I can and can't do and shouldn't do. Yap Stam was another one that I looked at and gutted that he didn't probably stay in the Premier League longer, because again, once he left, I wasn't paying much attention, even though he did remarkable things. But yeah, for me, Rio is the greatest.
I hope you all found that as illuminating as I did. Cheers for listening, for your reviews and requests for future guests. Now remember to appreciate good positioning and not just the highlights reel-worthy recovery tackle. oh, it's also a relief that it's okay to just applaud great goals and not microscopically look for faults. Between the Lines is a Stakhanov production, written and narrated by me, Melissa Reddy. Our producer is Charlie Morgan. Our assistant producer is Natalie Wilson. The executive producers are John Teague and Luke Aaron Moore. Sound design and mixing is by Tom Wally. All music comes courtesy of Epidemic Sound. Thanks for listening. Tune in next time.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.